Commonwealth, Mr. Valadie. We'll hear from you, and do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
If I could, Judge, can I reserve 3 minutes?
Yes, sir, 3 minutes.
And may it please the court, I'm Anthony Valadie here on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Barney. And I think just the baseline principle in this case, and the first question is, whether it is a valid hypothesis of innocence in use of a firearm cases, if, although there's testimony that the cashier or the victim may have perceived a firearm, there's testimony that at the time of the offense, the defendant said she had a firearm, is it still valid if there was no actual firearm used or any object that gave the appearance of having a firearm?
Mr. Malady, this is Judge Petty. I assume this is your sufficiency argument, and I think you stated the facts well. There was a finger or at least some object pointed from a jacket pocket. The defendant made the statement in one robbery that I have a gun, and of course both robberies were tried at the same time. And the court could infer that whatever was used in one was used in the other. Why, given that, why doesn't our decision in Powell, or the Supreme Court's decision in Powell and our decision in Elmore, control this case, or at least the sufficiency argument of it?
I think Powell does control, because Powell states that there's a conflict, and the conflict is whether the jury has to believe I was never given the opportunity, and this goes to the second time.
I understand. No, I understand. There's two arguments here. I want to talk about the sufficiency argument, though. We'll discuss your other argument maybe in a minute. But given the fact that the defendant admitted that she had a gun, that seems to be very similar to the decision in Powell that the trier of fact can consider circumstantial evidence and can assume that if one said they had a gun, they did have a gun.
Yes, sir. Well, just focusing, I guess, on the sufficiency. There was that testimony. There is some evidence supporting the idea that she had a gun. I would suppose the jury is entitled to disbelieve, to believe the statements at the time of the stand and disbelieve what Ms. Barney testified to in court. But there was also the additional evidence of I don't know if the court actually had a copy of the videos or had the opportunity to review the videos, but the firearm that was allegedly in her pocket goes away when her hand gets taken out of the pocket. There was agreement from at least one of the cashiers at the time that reviewing the video, there does not appear that the bulge goes away effectively when she moves her hand out of the pocket. There was testimony from a relative that Ms. Barney never used firearms. Again, Ms. Barney's own testimony. I think there was more evidence in my case, in the Barney case, than there was in the Powell case going to sufficiency. Of course, I would argue that my stronger argument is that the jury never got to resolve that conflict.
Of course, we're reviewing this in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. So when you say there's more evidence in your case, that doesn't really. Is there more evidence on favor of the Commonwealth's argument?
I don't think there's necessarily more evidence in favor of the Commonwealth's argument than there was in Powell. I believe similarly in Powell, there was statements, threats. He kept his hand in his pocket. The cashier never saw a gun. So the Commonwealth evidence is similar in Powell, but again, we have the fact that the video and the cashier's testimony in our case was more equivocal as to whether they actually believed that Ms. Barney had a gun. In Powell, I think the hand was in the pocket the entire time. In my case, we had the testimony about how the bulge went away when Ms. Barney's hand went out of her pocket. But in any case, the jury never got to resolve that conflict in the first place because it wasn't allowed to be presented to them. And this goes into my second assignment of error, where the trial court explicitly said, if you argue that an actual firearm was not used, I will declare a mistrial. I managed to proffer what my closing argument would have been. And it just, it goes to, again, going back to the beginning, the trial court in this case, perhaps understandably, appeared to be confused about the state of the law regarding use of a firearm and whether you need to actually possess a firearm. You either need to actually possess a firearm, according to Starton, or an instrument that looks close enough to a firearm to retain the appearance of having a firing capability, even if it didn't. That was the instruction I gave, again, going to my first assignment of error, and that was fundamentally what the argument would have been in my case and what the jury should have had the opportunity to resolve. Either they believe Ms. Barney or they don't. But what was established by the trial court's ruling, both on the jury instructions and on what I could argue in closing argument, that was cut off to me. Effectively, even if the jury believed that Ms. Barney did not have an actual firearm or any object that looked like a firearm, they still had to convict her. And that is not right under Starton, and that is not right under any cases quoted either by the Attorney General, by the Commonwealth Attorney at trial. Again, Powell, there's a conflict in the evidence over whether Powell had a gun or not, and it gets to be resolved by the Commonwealth. It gets to be resolved by the jury. Yarbrough, famously, Starton, all of these cases, it's an issue for the jury to determine. And if the instructions are written in such a way, and the judge explicitly instructs the defense, the counsel, and the jury, it doesn't matter if she had a gun or not. It doesn't matter if she had an instrument that looked like a firearm or not. That's taken away from the jury, and that is the core for decades, ever since Yarbrough, since Starton, for certainly, there is still the requirement of actual use of a firearm, actual possession of a firearm. It can go through the cases. Again, looking through the cases, the Commonwealth cites, there's the Kinlaw case that just came out from this court within the last few years, which states that the jury, a valid hypothesis of innocence is that the defendant merely said he had a gun and did not actually possess one. That was my hypothesis of innocence. That was what was I attempted to present to the trial court, both through instructions and through argument at the end. And the court made an explicit ruling that denied me that opportunity, denied Ms. Barney the opportunity to present her reasonable hypothesis of innocence. Going more directly into the instructions, the court has read my brief, of course. The Castillo case, which granted is pre-Starton, explicitly rejected the instruction that was offered by the Commonwealth in this case because it is a robbery instruction, and that's where the trial court's confusion came from. Robbery, you don't need an actual firearm. It is merely enough that the victim perceived a firearm to possibly be present. That's enough for armed robbery. Same with the threats, but it is not enough for use of a firearm. And the
your client had pled guilty to robbery, and so that was not even an issue before the jury, right?
Yes, which distinguishes this case also from another case the Attorney General cited, which was the Gibbs case. That issue was not before the jury. The Commonwealth introduced a robbery instruction that had a completely different definition of firearm, completely different definition of what it means to commit an armed robbery. That, the quite frankly, they just used the wrong instruction. They used the model instruction as it goes to robbery. What I had proffered was the model instruction as it went to use of a firearm. The instruction I used, which unfortunately did not make it into the court's record, but the instruction I proffered was almost verbatim from the Starton case. I had an alternative instruction from Wubna, from the Wubna case, but my Starton instruction was directly from that case. It was a model instruction. It applied to the use of a firearm, and it was rejected in favor of an instruction that did not accurately define
Excuse me, Mr. Valley. It's just whoever is banging or typing, could you please not do that? Thank you. I'm sorry, sir.
Thank you, Judge. Judge, I don't want to give the Attorney General any ideas, but I think the only argument potentially is that Miss Barney's finger or her hand informing the bulge, assuming that my theory of the case is correct, is an instrumentality that retained the appearance of a firearm, and that's also not supported by the case law. When we're talking about, it always mentions instrument, which I would suggest is an object and something that retains the appearance of having a firing capability. And in Sartin, we're talking about some kind of replica pistol. In Courtney, I think it was a toy gun or something like that. But we're talking about objects that have the general cliche appearance of being a pistol or a firearm.
Would you agree that if a person had their finger in their pocket, but nobody knew that, and the victim simply saw a protrusion in the pocket, and the defendant said, "I have a gun, give me the money," wouldn't that be sufficient to convict for use of a firearm in the commission of a felony?
I believe it is not sufficient. There is a case that was directly on point, and
you're thinking Yarborough?
It was not Yarborough, because Yarborough, they had the additional beneficial fact of
in Yarborough, the beer bottle was recovered. In Yarborough, there was no statement by the defendant as to what it was. There was simply an object in the pocket.
Oh, in your hypothetical, I'm sorry, Judge, I misheard you. Defendant says it is a gun?
Yes. I mean, that seems to be Powell and Bies and, I'm sorry, Powell and Elmore and really Courtney, too. Courtney,
I think
they didn't recover, and Courtney specifically says this is not about whether the toy gun resembles an actual gun. Nelson did not see the object used by Courtney. The question was whether there was circumstantial evidence in the statement of the defendant to allow a jury to conclude that he had a gun.
I think it's certainly possible, given a statement, "I have a gun," and then the bulge, and the victim heard the statement, saw the bulge. "I thought he had a firearm," is testimony. And in the absence of any contradicting evidence or other circumstantial evidence, I think that could be enough to convict. It's certainly enough to go to the jury and have the jury decide.
You're talking about sufficiency at this point, as opposed to viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the proponent of an instruction. Those are two different standards, aren't they?
They are, Judge. The evidence as presented at that trial raised the issue of whether there was an actual firearm used or not. And when I propounded the instruction as to the definition of a firearm, because it was at issue whether she had a firearm or not, I think the evidence as it came out of trial supported that instruction. A prior decision by this court fairly recently, there was the Mitchell decision in 2012, where this court actually issued a rather scathing opinion towards a defense attorney who failed to argue that when there was just a bulge present and perhaps just statements, I don't recall exactly, but when there was just a bulge and no actual firearm was seen, for failing to argue that there was no firearm actually used in the offense. And just to go back to the instructions, what we have here is a case where, and I think it's clear from reading the transcript, both the Commonwealth attorney and the judge had a misapprehension of what the law was. All of the instructions and the judge's decision not to allow certain kinds of argument all make sense if you assume they were prosecuting someone for robbery. If we assume that all they had to prove was an armed robbery, but the armed robbery had been dealt with, she pled to it before trial. The only thing at issue was use of a firearm, use of official of a firearm since Yarborough, since Starton, for decades has been actual use of a firearm. Every single case cited by myself, cited by the AG, and cited by the Commonwealth Attorney contains that language and says that if the theory of innocence is that no actual firearm was used, then that is a question for the jury. So I think my first two assignments of error certainly go towards the jury should have been allowed to make to deliberate on that issue, to be allowed to decide it, and that was taken from them by the trial court in this instance. So if there are no other questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well. Thank you. Ms. Tyson?
Yes, and may it please the court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. And I'd like to argue about sufficiency because obviously that has more dire consequences if we lose on sufficiency. But I think that the jury instruction probably is more naturally what I should argue first. I need to say, first of all, that the instruction...
Could I start out with what exactly does the do you think the Commonwealth has to prove under 53.1?
I think that after all of the cases that have evolved, I think that the Commonwealth has got to prove that the victim reasonably believed that there was a firearm that was being used.
But that's Yarborough, and Yarborough was reversed.
Well, absolutely it was, and that was the beer can back in those days. But,
exactly.
I think the law has evolved quite a bit. And, Starton is sort of the gold standard to look at. And what I think is really important in Starton is, and this court said it one way and the Supreme Court said it another, but both courts ended up saying that there was a twofold or a dual purpose of 53.1. And the second of those was to discourage criminal conduct that produces fear that there is a firearm. And
Starton, I kind of thought, gave us the answer to my question, because the Supreme Court, in quoting this court, said the Court of Appeals correctly held that because 53.1 is aimed at preventing an actual physical injury or death, the term firearm includes any instrument capable of expelling a projectile by force of gunpowder. That's an actual firearm. And it says, as importantly, the term also includes other objects that are not capable of firing projectiles but give the appearance of being able to do so. So don't you have to prove that the individual had one of those two things?
I don't think so. And I think that the reason Starton is that way is that anything more than that would have been dicta in that case, because there was a replica of a firearm that was used.
Do you have any case that says that you can, that it's solely the perception, the subjective perception of the victim that determines whether it's a firearm or not?
Well, and I don't think it's solely the perception of the victim. I think there has to be this a reasonableness part of that test, and I think that's Powell. Courtney is almost there, and of course Courtney was decided the same day as Starton. The victim never saw anything in Courtney. Now, they ended up finding a toy gun in the car at the gas station later, but in Powell they never found anything. He said he had a gun.
Yeah, but in Courtney and Powell both, the defendant said, I have a gun.
Right.
And basically the court said, well, that's sufficient for the jury to conclude you actually did have a firearm. So it's a question of how you prove what the person has, not what the individual actually has to possess.
I'm not sure I understood the last part of what you said. I'm sorry.
Well, you have to possess either a firearm or, to use Starton, a replica of a firearm. Now, you can prove that circumstantially. And if the person sticks his finger in the pocket and says, I have a gun, then the jury can conclude the object in that pocket is, in fact, either an actual firearm or a replica. But there's two different things there.
Well, and I do understand your question now. And I guess my response to that would be that it shouldn't be easier shouldn't be easier to avoid liability when you don't show what you've got in your pocket than if you do. And that maybe that's a really bad way of saying that.
It should be easier for the Commonwealth to prove a case if they can't prove the case.
Well, no. That's certainly not what I intended to say, Your Honor. What I mean is that in Starton, there was the John Wayne replica, and that was produced. And so that's the issue that the court was addressing. But in Powell and Courtney, the victim did not see a gun at all. Now, here, in our case, we have especially the first witness who testified. I'm looking at page 180 of the appendix, notes that, why did you think it was a gun, line 13. I saw an imprint of what appeared to be a gun barrel and what a gun barrel will make if it was being poked through the article of clothing. And so now we're getting more back to Elmore, and the victims are being told that they had that Barney had a gun, and it sure looks like it to them. And I might add that not only did the jury have the opportunity, and I guess I'm sort of talking sufficiency now, not only did the jury have the opportunity to hear the victims testify, they had a chance to see those surveillance tapes as well. And so in making their determination, this was not an unreasonable conclusion based on the acts and the statements and the actions of the defendant in this case.
Let me flip over just a moment, if I might, to the issue of the judges prohibiting the defense attorney from arguing that it wasn't a gun. Isn't that the when we talk about what the Commonwealth has to prove,
right.
Isn't that really the nub of the case? And if it wasn't a gun, or if it wasn't something that looked like a gun, then the defendant could not be convicted.
I think first of all, Your Honor, and I want to answer your question. I think that what the judge actually did in this case is in a very limited place in the appendix. I think we need to look at exactly what happened in this case. At the beginning of the trial, it's actually during opening statement, and there's a break, and they are discussing the instructions. I'm looking at my notes say Joint Appendix 158. And the judge says, she didn't have a gun, that's fine. The problem comes when you say she cannot be found guilty unless there is an actual gun. And the defendant says, well, that's what Yarbrough says. And he also relies on Castillo, which I would argue is not really very good law at this juncture. But so this is when they start out, and they're talking about an actual gun. And clearly under even Starton, but certainly Courtney and Powell, that's not the law. You don't have to have an actual firearm. Okay, so that's the first time. Then later, as they are arguing the instructions, and this is at 340 to 341 of the appendix, then it's a little bit broader. But what the judge says there, I'm sorry, let me flip over my page here, is if you argue to the jury that your client is not guilty because there's not a firearm, I think you're asking for a mistrial. Well, and again, that's not exactly the law. You don't have to have an actual firearm. And, of course, the defense was arguing at that point a firearm or an instrument that looked like a gun. But even flipping over here to page 341, counsel says, for the purpose of the record, I ask the court to note my exception. And then counsel says, so I'm clear. I cannot argue that there was not actually a firearm used in this case. And the court says, and that based on that, she is not guilty. So then we have a proffer of what counsel would have said, which is at the 341 to 342, and he says, I'll proffer, I will have argued that if I had the opportunity, she just placed her finger in the pocket and there was no instrumentality or firearm. To me, what the court was saying is that counsel could not argue to the jury if she did not have an actual firearm, she could not be convicted. Now, it's a little bit murky because he did mention the other instrumentality, and obviously I have to concede that he did say that. But that to me is what the judge was forbidding when you look at all of that together, is to say it had to be an actual bullet expelling firearm or she's not guilty. And that's what the judge was saying he couldn't argue. It is not as clear as it could be, but to me, that's what the judge was prohibiting in the case. And so in that regard, the court was just exercising its discretion as far as what could be argued. I don't think that was a clear and correct statement of the law. So well, the court didn't err.
Ms. Tyson, yes. This is Judge Huff. The Commonwealth still had the burden of proving the use of a firearm, didn't they? I mean, the charge was 18.253.1.
Unlawful it was, Your Honor.
The user attempt.
So, it was. And I think that... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is I think maybe this would be the time to look at the jury instruction issue. Because the same issue really does come up in all three assignments of error, as Mr. Ballady said. But in the jury instruction issue, the instruction that the court gave is a model instruction in the dangerous weapons chapter of the Virginia's model jury instructions. It's not a robbery instruction. And I think that it's very important. I know they're unpublished opinions. He relied on Castillo from 2000, which actually was my case, even though I did not remember it. But in 2012, this court, after Starton, said that very instruction was an accurate statement of the law.
Let me give you a hypothetical. And my vision is terrible. I'm very nearsighted. And suppose somebody comes up to me and points a banana at me. And because I'm nearsighted, I can't really tell what it is. And the guy says, I got a gun. Give me your money. Is that a use of a firearm in the commission of felony? Because I happen to think it's a gun, even though it's clearly not one.
Boy, and that is the really hard one, because since Sprouse has been overruled, we know that if you have a toy, but it's a toy that looks sort of like a gun, then that's going to be good enough. But I think there is the victim's reasonable apprehension, and so I think the argument would be in that case that it was not a reasonable apprehension. And I know that your nearsightedness may be the reason for it, but that would be the distinction.
Suppose the banana is very ripe.
I knew that was
coming. Ripe and black. Yeah, the point is, it seems to me that this is not a subjective standard that we apply. It's not what did the victim think. It might be the reason that we've expanded the definition because of the concern of the victim. But ultimately, it seems to me that the case law is pretty clear. It has to be something that either is a gun or resembles a gun.
And, Your Honor, the best response I would have to that is that if that were the end of the inquiry, then I think that this court, neither this court nor the Supreme Court, would need to have said that there's a dual purpose or a twofold purpose of that statute. And the second one of those purposes was to discourage criminal conduct that produces the fear.
The Supreme Court said that when it expanded the definition of firearm to include the replica firearm. Otherwise, the replica wouldn't qualify.
Right. And of course, this court expressly overruled Sprouse in its decision in Starton, and the Supreme Court didn't address that at all. But I think that certainly that is a reading of Starton, but I also think that if there really is that second purpose, then when the defendant says, I have guns pointed at you, if you remain calm, you won't die, and keeps her hand in her pocket in the way that this particular defendant did, then the actual firearm requirement has been met. An actual firearm requirement has been met if you've got something that looks like a gun, whether it's a replica or a toy that is sufficiently looks like a gun, or whatever it is that you have, the concern about the fear and the reasonable apprehension of the victim come into play in those instances and will establish that element of the offense. And that's why in this particular case, given all of the evidence that we have, the evidence was sufficient, the jury instruction was not incorrect, and the court did not err in limiting the argument of the defense counsel. Now, I will say, Kinlaw is a case, and Kinlaw actually was affirmed. That was not reversed when there was never a firearm seen. The trial judge made a comment about the defendant's bulky clothing, and even this court made mention that certainly the firearm could have been disposed of at some point, and certainly with regard to sufficiency in this case, the same thing is true here. There were two robberies on two different days, and the the defendant could have disposed of it. And I realize that is a sufficiency argument and not in line with the instruction or the summation issues. But the bottom line is, with regard to Kinlaw, we had a similar situation. It wasn't days, it was minutes, but still this defendant could have discarded a firearm if because she had that amount of time. So
let
we
me
would
ask
urge
you one
the,
question.
Yes.
Let me ask you one other question, and this is about, I think it was the first robbery, if I'm recalling the facts correctly. But in one robbery, the defendant said, "I have a gun," and in the other robbery, she did not make that statement. But the cases were being tried together. So could the court infer that the item that she had in her pocket, whatever it was the same item that she had when she said, "This is a gun"?
Yes, I think Mosley. I don't know if I cited that case because I don't know that the issue came up, but Commonwealth versus Mosley and the Supreme Court would certainly support that that was a reasonable inference that the court could make. And in this case, she presented a note at one time about staying calm and not dying, and then and the other one said, "You have two guns pointed at you," and that was in the second robbery with Ms. Cooper, and Ms. Doherty was the one who got the note. And in Ms. Doherty's case, that she had her hands in the kangaroo pocket, and in fact, as I recall from the video, her hands actually stayed in the pockets and went up on the counter. But I guess it's not really in responsive to your question. But yes, that inference is a reasonable inference, and I would rely on Mosley for that principle. And I'm happy, of course, to answer any additional questions, but I would urge the court to affirm the judgment of the Circuit Court of Hampton.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Bellotti, you have no more than 2 minutes, probably a little less.
Then just very briefly, Judge, I think the Attorney General, that's the most favorable possible explanation of the trial court's statements limiting what counsel could have argued. I did say it's an actual firearm or an instrumentality. The court was clear that I was not allowed to argue if in that statement, pretty much not allowed to argue anything related to that she didn't have a firearm, is therefore not guilty. The argument was limited solely to whether the cashier, the victim's perception was reasonable, which is why I had such a stilted closing argument. And there's just no case law for the idea that it is the cashier's perception and whether it is reasonable or not that applies to the use of a firearm statute. It matters a lot in robbery, but it does not matter. It hardly matters at all the use of a firearm. It only goes to more evidence of the use of a firearm, what the cashier actually saw. It is not dispositive, as the trial court essentially indicated. And you cannot remove... You cannot take one statement from the trial court, give the most favorable possible interpretation of it, and remove it from the context of everything else that happened throughout the course of that entire trial, where over the course of 2 days and X many pages of appendix and transcript, we discussed this very issue multiple times from opening arguments to closing, and it became clear through the course of the trial that the trial court had a misapprehension of Starton and what the law is as it applies to 53.1. I would ask the court to reverse Ms. Barney's conviction. Failing that, I would ask the court to remand the case back for a new trial with the understanding of under assignments of error 1 and 2.
Very well. Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We'll move